But today, today we're going to focus on women in the Holocaust. Now, this is a massive undertaking, which we're only going to just kind of give the bibliography for, which I gave you. I know that this is something that the museum that you're working on specifically. The most incredible work that has been done on this topic is by a cousin of Faye Levinson, who is not here right now, which is, I was hoping she would be here so I could give her a big shout out. She's not here. Yeah. Yes, it is being recorded. So you get a shout out. She has a cousin whose name is Yehoshua Abishitz. Yehoshua Abishitz, I don't know how old he is, but he wrote 7 volumes of scholarship on women and religious life in the Holocaust. One of it's called, five or seven, some of them have different names, called Ha'isha Bashoah. It's in your bibliography. I mention this by way of introduction because he is the world expert, you could say. And, thanks to Faye, I spoke to him. I don't know exactly how old he is. I didn't do the math from his autobiography from the war. But I spoke to him in Hebrew. He's here in America now. I actually asked him if I could get a hold of these books, which are not so easy to get a hold of. So that'll be for a further conversation because they're published in Israel. But he is 100% sharp. She said that he's blind. But when I spoke to him on the phone, we spoke in Hebrew. He knew exactly what I was talking about. He knew the books I was talking about. He told me exactly why he got interested in this, because after everything that he had gone through, the various camps and his family members and everything, this is what it was going to be like, his life's work. I think in total, he published at least 9 volumes of scholarship. Most of them are in Hebrew. One of them is a translation of his autobiography. It's amazing works. So this volume, this is the 5th in the series of Ha'isha Bashoah, which this is the one that that Faye lent me, but I was able, through my connections with the Yeshiva University, to get online copies of most of his books. I have online access to actually reading them, so I have some of the works today. But this is an amazing enterprise, and he looks at the role of women in the Holocaust from a lot of different vantage points, from a family vantage point, from a religious vantage point. This whole volume is about women and girls and the influence of the church. Women, young women, girls who had been hidden in convents, other things like that. It's an entire volume. It's got 7 volumes just on this one topic, in addition to 2 other volumes called Bikdusha uBikvura, with sanctity and with strength. Amazing. And you could talk to him on the telephone. It's an amazing thing. So that's kind of, if you want the expert on this topic, Yehoshua Abishitz is really an amazing resource. So we'll draw on that a little bit. I want to think about this in 3 frames. The first is the unique suffering of women in the Holocaust, the complexity of the experience of women in the Holocaust, and then the heroism, the religious heroism, the spiritual resistance of women in the Holocaust. I suspect that most of you have read a lot about the Holocaust, memoirs and such, probably a lot more than I have. Some of this material, some of this reading is not so easy. Some of it's extremely difficult. I would say that this book that I'm going to introduce to you is one of the more difficult books that I have found and I have read. It was difficult for me. I didn't read a lot of this book. It was very difficult. I find that this book, which I have read parts of it before, and there are other books on the medical experimentation during the war, I just feel it's hard to read. It's really just at a level like... So this is the first volume I'm going to introduce you to, and it's called Sexual Violence Against Jewish Women During the Holocaust. This volume was published in 2010, and it's a collection of essays, aspects of abuse of Jewish women during the Holocaust. And one of the notes of the introductory article is that we suffer from stereotypes in life and difficulties about speaking about certain aspects, and that only in recent years has the abuse of women in the Holocaust become something that people could talk about. Right? We all know that in the first years after the war, people didn't speak in general very much about the experiences that they had. And some have observed that the Eichmann trial opened up the doors for many people to talk about what they experienced in the Holocaust. But even beyond that, the specific abuse of women during the war is not something that was generally addressed, certainly not in a scholarly fashion. And yet, now, this is the beginning, this book writes, the beginning of greater scholarship and greater emphasis on understanding the unique suffering that women experienced during the war. And obviously, there's a lot more to be said than I could ever understand, or that even collectively we could really wrap our heads around in terms of what the experience meant. Because when you start thinking about, and that's why it's so painful, when you read the experience of one person and what that meant to them and how that destroyed them as a person, and then you magnify it and you continue to magnify it to the point where you can't even wrap your head around it, it's overwhelming. But what they describe here is the existence of sexual slavery and prostitution, forced prostitution and rape that existed in different places in different ways, whether it was in death camps or was in ghettos and all different kinds of circumstances. These abuses, which are in a certain sense, they're far beyond in terms of the impact, the devastating impact that it could have on a person, far beyond the impact of the regular, quote unquote, regular forced labor of people who were working in quarries or wherever they were forced to be enslaved, and how these women were so traumatized that many of them couldn't speak about it afterwards. In addition to the inability to speak about the whole experience, but many of them were wholly ashamed. So this is a book that is extremely intense, and I put it on the bibliography because if you want to get it, I was able to get it by interlibrary loan. For those who are in the Skokie library system, you can get books for free from basically anywhere in the world, and you just order them and they'll send them to you. They'll get them from another library. This library came from the Northbrook Public Library. Shout out to the Northbrook guys. But it discusses the different, there are various sexual exploitation of women in Nazi concentration camp brothels, and the Kahina Vahina. It's very, yeah.
Are these books translated into?
This is only English. This is an English volume. In your bibliography, the books that are, I wrote the titles in English. The only ones that are in Hebrew are the ones where the title is also in Hebrew. Those are all Hebrew. But this one is an English volume. It's published by, was it Yale University Press? Brandeis University Press. And it's very difficult to read. And you think about this from a religious standpoint. What did it mean to these women? You're talking about girls very often who came from very modest homes, pious homes, who had never, they never experienced, you know, they were in, oftentimes in a kind of a segregated type of environment. This is like, really is beyond words. There's no words for them to put to it. So the question is, so how from a religious standpoint did people grapple with this? So of course there was a variety of different perspectives and a variety of different answers, but I'll share with you a question, because one of the ways in which people dealt with resistance, as we've discussed over the course of the year, is a spiritual perspective, a way to maintain the personal dignity that you identify with, that says, this is who I am, and that exists true on a religious level, that a person who identifies that God is a significant part of their life as, as a spiritual and religious being, so nobody could take that away from you, and nobody could take it away from these women. So very, very often the experience of the Shoah is going to be met with a religious response, which we've talked about in different ways. So here is a question that comes from the world of responsa. I don't remember if it was 2 times ago or 3 times ago. At some point, this is going to be review for some. We mentioned the name of a rabbi. His name is Rabbi Ephraim Oshri. He died in New York at the age of 89. His obituary was published in the New York Times. So he was a young rabbi in the Kovno ghetto. Kovno is, anybody remember where Kovno is? Suburb of?
Vilna.
Right, the suburb of Vilna. A deeply religious community. And when he was In the ghetto, he had access to some small scraps of paper, which he used to write down questions, religious questions, that were posed to him. After the war, he comes back there, a whole long discussion, it would be a whole session just to figure out how he reconstructed his notes and found his papers and made his way to America. He rebuilt his life. Unbelievable story in and of itself. And he compiled the questions that he got and the answers into volumes of responsa. So I'll share with you one just in the Hebrew, and then I'll quote a couple from a secondary volume in English. You're talking about abuse. Here's the question. This is from his volume. It's called She'elot U'Tshuvot, Questions and Answers, Mimamakim. Mimamakim means from the depths. That's what he's describing. So he says, immediately, I'm translating freely for you. This is in question 27. Immediately after we were freed from the ghetto, I was asked an awesome and difficult question that was not just pertinent to this questioner, Ela gam lemispar rav, to a great number of Jewish girls, Benos Yisrael Achiros, other Jewish girls, who were fortunate enough to survive, that's what he writes, Lehisha'er b'chayim. However, he's quoting now, the following phrase is a rabbinic phrase from a verse of Lamentations, Eicha. When do we read Lamentations? On Tisha B'Av. So he's invoking in this religious letter, in this responsa, the image of mourning on Tisha B'Av. That's the context of this phrase. Paras Yodo al kol machmadeim, that they outstretch their hands on all of the precious. Machmadim are the precious ones. So in this case, it's a reference to the women. The women are referred to as the precious ones. Umasran lekalon ulaboshes, and took these women and gave them over for kalon, which means shame and embarrassment. That's euphemistic for forced prostitution. Kedei, in order, shepritze hachayos v'chazire hayar, that the wild animals and boars of the forest, who's that a reference to? The Germans. Kalgase hagermanim, the Germans' officers, yis'alu begufan u'bechvodam, they should abuse and molest their bodies and their honor. And here is the question. A girl comes from a nice family, isha tzi'ira liyamim, she's a young woman, Me'achbas ha'mishpachos ha'nechbodos shebekovno, one of the most prestigious and distinguished families in our neighborhood in Kovno. V'dimaso alecheya, she has tears on her face. Again, this phrase, his Hebrew phrase, v'dimaso alecheya, tears on her face, is taken from the verse in Lamentations. So he's mixing in the narrative, the question, but with the emotion. When you read this, he wants you to think the suffering of the Jewish people of eternity, of Tisha B'Av, of people sitting on the floor and the crying. That's part of, it's not just a question and an answer from a rabbi. It's, he's understanding, he's trying to convey the feeling, what this is all about, the destruction. That's what Tisha B'Av is going to be in August. Tisha B'Av is about the destruction. It's the day of commemorating all the calamities. So he's conveying that feeling with this girl who comes to him. V'dimasa lechiya, her tears are on her face. And she says, she has no comfort, and she wants to know, she was one of these women who was trapped by the Germans, v'nimzera leboshes, and she was given over to prostitution, and not only did they abuse her, they took an implement and they tattooed on her arm the words, Zona Bishvil Chayalei Hitler, prostitute for the soldiers of Hitler. That's what they tattooed on her arm. He says, something amazing happened. She was, after the war, able to find her husband from before the war. And the two of them would like to rebuild their house, rebuild their life, to get back together. All of their children were destroyed, were killed. They want to rebuild their family. But with this, when her husband sees this on her arm, he wants to know what is the legal status of his wife. Because they are still married, right? From a Jewish standpoint, they had never been divorced. However, there is a halachic principle, there is a Jewish law principle that if it's called a
sota.
A woman who has an affair with someone else. So in that case, she is prohibited to return to her original husband. Ever. That's it.
She doesn't have an affair.
Oh, so she says the following. Here's her question. She says, look, it's mamish heartbreaking. It's difficult to imagine. She says, this is what she's asking the rabbi. She comes and she says, look, I was in this place for a long time. And she's worried. She says, what happened when I was there? The law is that if a woman, God forbid, Rahman al-Islam, had been raped, then she's not prohibited to her husband. She's not a sota. She didn't commit any infidelity. But she worries, ulai nivala lahem baratzon. Maybe one time, one day, she went along willingly. And if it's the case that at one time she really did go along with it, then she would have the status of a sota, of a woman who had been unfaithful to her husband, and she's no longer permitted to remarry. And she says, look, I can't tell you what was going on over there. Maybe it happened. So what's the rule? That's what she wants to know. That's the question. It's unbelievable. So, before I give you the answer, he concludes with something that's also amazing. At the end, he says, you should know that, you know, the question, the second part of it was what to do with this tattoo. Does she legally have to remove the tattoo? He says, at the end, you should know that you're not obligated to have the tattoo removed. And one could say that you could feel a badge of honor, that you can look at that tattoo and see how you are able to survive and be able to put your life back together. So that itself, you can look at that from a whole other standpoint of the question of the tattoo that's on her arm. Now obviously if she wants to have the tattoo removed, she can have the tattoo removed. But his point was, you're not obligated legally, from a Jewish law standpoint, you're not obligated to have the tattoo removed. But before that, he spends three pages of legal rabbinic discussion to explain how, even if it was the case that one day she may have gone along willingly with what someone had asked her to do, but because the entire circumstance was such that it wasn't a consensual agreement that she should be in such a place, God forbid, she was being forced there. And the overall threat of what would happen to her if she said no, which obviously does not, it's not an option if you want to remain alive in this circumstance. So he ruled, Rabbi Oshri told this woman that you are permitted to return home and to rebuild your life and to return to your original husband, because everything that happened there is going to be under the halachic codification, so to speak. It's going to be deemed as, that's rape. That's not, that wasn't any consensual intercourse. So here you have one woman, one family, one question, which gives you a window into what the type of experience was in the Kovno ghetto, and you can extrapolate from there, obviously, on a much more magnified scale. But also you see how this woman and her husband, they were committed to the Jewish life that they had before, and they were going to go back to the same values and the same life system that they had, and that was their way of returning. And so he blessed them that they should have a happy life and be able to move on. Yes. So this book has all different perspectives on that, the question of the social, you know, and the emotional, psychological impact, obviously, for sure. I mean, I would have to do a lot more research to be able to answer that question authoritatively, but it certainly was the case. The other unique aspects that they're going to talk about in this volume, which we're not going to talk about, which I really did not read very much about, because it's the medical experimentation that was done specifically on women, because we know that was part of the of the various medical experiments that were done, so it was also experimentation on women's reproductive experiment, among other experiments that they did about keeping people in cold water temperatures and high altitudes, other kinds of like. But here's an example of where the experience of the Shoah, the horrors of the Shoah, is viewed through a religious lens of this heroic woman who wants to try to put her life back together again. So that's one, that's just one small window. The second, I would say, part of this comes from a very interesting volume in English. You have it on your list, called The Holocaust and Halacha. So here is a compilation of different responses, different questions that came up. And here, the author, Irving Rosenbaum, actually collects several different letters, several different questions that came up from Rabbi Oshry in another context. This is under the section, Be Fruitful and Multiply, Birth Control and Abortion. Another question, another series of questions that's primarily unique to women. The women are asking the question. So in Kovno, they describe that on the, he describes here, he documents that on May 7th, 1942, the Germans promulgated a decree that any woman who was found to be pregnant in the ghetto would be killed. So immediately, Rabbi Oshry was asked whether or not women were allowed to use various forms of contraception. Because there's a big question in Jewish law. What forms of contraception are permitted and when? And that's a whole big discussion, not for right now, but there are different gradations. That's the first question that came up. Another question that came up on August 9th, 1942. A woman who had already become pregnant, is it permitted for her to have an abortion? Under Jewish law, abortion is a highly restricted activity. It's not absolutely always prohibited, but it is largely prohibited. There are very few extenuating circumstances. So here's another one of them. The last one that I'll mention here, also, it's very difficult to even to read this case. The day that the day that the decree was issued, on that day, May 7th, was the 20th of Iyar. He was, Rabbi Oshry was near the hospital, and an SS man saw a pregnant woman in the street. And he shot at her, and she fell, and he assumed that she was dead. So bystanders picked up the woman, carried her to the hospital, and a Jewish physician who was there suggested to Rabbi Oshry, who was there, that maybe he should do an immediate cesarean section to try to save the fetus inside of this woman. So here you don't have a chance to look at books, you just have to know what the answer is. And it's a complicated question. Why is it such a complicated question? What would you say?
Whose life is more important?
Okay. Exactly. On the one hand, you say, you know, it seems like their initial assumption was that the woman had been killed by the bullet. But can you be sure? Is it by taking out the fetus, you're now going to take the life of the mother? And then whose life takes precedence? This goes to the abortion question. Generally speaking, with the Mishnah, it's a Talmudic passage, which is the beginning of a large discussion. Generally speaking, if the fetus is endangering the life of the mother, so then the mother's pre-existing life takes precedence. But in this case, we're not sure whether the mother's life is there. He said immediately yes, and
yes, what?
To allow the physician to cut open the woman and take out the baby.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, wait, can't they tell if she's alive by her heartbeat?
So I'm assuming, based on what they're describing, that it was such a chaotic situation and she was clearly near death that it was not clear whether she had expired already or not. So he marshals in his mind the discussion in the Talmud. He immediately thinks of the discussion in the Talmud in a case where a woman is in labor, but there's difficulty and the question of whose life comes first. And he concludes that saving a life is of chief importance. And let's say the mother is deceased, but then we have a prohibition against desecrating a deceased body. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, you could say if you could save the life of the child, so then you should do that. So for that reason, he told the doctor to do the operation. And they did. The postscript is very, very terrible, and I'll just share it with you because it'll close this loop. He describes that the Germans were very punctual, so they came back to the hospital. And when they saw that the child had been removed alive, one of them took the infant, smashed it against the wall, and killed it in the hospital. And he concludes the section, "May God remember these evil days to the children of these monsters and to their children's children so that they receive their just reward for what they did unto us." So here is another aspect. Obviously the coda is even more like heart-rending, but the suffering that was unique to women, these questions primarily are being dealt with by women when you're talking about the contraception and the life and death questions. So that's one whole set of issues about the effects of the Holocaust specifically on women and how they're going to deal with it from a religious standpoint. Then the second unit that I want to focus on. Time flies. The second unit is what we'll call complexity. And we're going to go a little bit over time today. Is that okay? Just a few minutes. Oh, thank you. And that is, we can call complexity. Whereas, there's no doubt that there were many, and we're going to come back to them in a minute, there were many incredibly heroic and amazing women who demonstrated superhuman spiritual strength during the Holocaust. However, that's not always the case. And we should understand that. And we can't romanticize it and pretend as if everybody was perfect and everything was like 100% the way that we wish it would have been from some idealized vision. And here we turn our attention to Rabbi Shimon Huberband. Rabbi Huberband was the focus of our last talk. He was the member, the religious, the rabbinic member of Emanuel Ringelblum's Onig Shabbos archives. He was responsible for chronicling the Jewish life. And that's on your bibliography. It's called Kiddush Hashem, Jewish Religious and Cultural Life in Poland During the Holocaust. So last time, at that time, we saw a little bit about his life and about his work. So this is the English translation, the English version of Kiddush Hashem. And actually, in the footnote here, they point out that Dr. Ringelblum actually had an entire plan of research to explore and to document the role of women during the Holocaust. It was supposed to be a set of hypotheses, the attitude of the Germans toward Jewish women, the influence on the ghetto life of various types of women. They actually had a woman who was involved in composing a study called The Jewish Woman in Warsaw from September 1939 until the present, which was early 1942. Her name was Celina Slapokova. So Rabbi Huberband had written an essay about Jewish women in the war. It was comprised of several sections, but only one of the sections survived, and that's the one we have here. It's printed as chapter 30 in the book. And what is the title of this? This title gives you a lot of insight. Again, we're not going to try to generalize in either direction. The title is "The Moral Suffering and Moral Decline of the Jewish Woman." And there are four chapters. The Moral Suffering of the Jewish Woman, chapter 2 is Agunas. Agunas are women whose husbands disappeared and they are in limbo whether they can remarry according to Jewish law. 3 is the moral decline of the Jewish woman during the war, and 4 is addenda to chapter 1. So the only section that we have is the section from chapter 3. The rest of it disappeared. So what does he describe? he describes that in general, he starts off by saying, if Jews in general have been called the compassionate children of the Compassionate One, that's what we call in Hebrew, Rachmanim, B'nei Rachmanim, merciful, comes from Rachmanus. Familiar, like the Yiddish expression, Rachmanus. Then the Jewish women should be called the appellation even more so. The Jewish woman has always exhibited great compassion, both in individual situations and in public campaigns for the needy. Why is it called Rachmanus? Why is compassion called Rachmanus? What is the root of the Hebrew word Rachmanut? Rechem. Rechem means uterus in Hebrew. Because women are hardwired. They are biologically and emotionally, physiologically predisposed to have compassion. Child raising. I never had an epidural. I never had a delivery. I was very supportive. I didn't faint. I had to leave, but I didn't faint. But I never, you know, let's get real here. Like, Rachmanus, because a motherly instinct, a motherly compassion is unique. That's why the word Rachamim, compassion, is associated with the word Rechem, with mothers. So he says, Rabbi Huberban, Jewish women traditionally are the most compassionate. And he says, you know what I see? Unfortunately, I see cases of children. It says, late in December 1941, I saw with my own eyes a boy of 16 years old lying on the ground at the corner of Carmelika and Nowalipki. Everybody knows I don't speak anything but English. Maybe a little bit Yiddish, a little bit Hebrew, not so much Spanish, but this, I'm sorry for butchering the names. In the freezing cold in late 1941, three small children lay alongside him, one smaller than the other. They were all nearly totally naked. Scores of people passed them by, but rarely did anyone throw them any alms. And he describes how my attention was drawn to a young man who was walking arm in arm with two girls. All three of them were elegantly dressed in fine furs and fine boots. I stood and watched from the distance. The three young people stopped next to the unfortunate Jewish children, and I was certain they were about to open their purses and bags of goodies, which they held in their hands, because he describes that there was, near this, there was a candy store. And remember, in the ghetto, it was like this bizarre juxtaposition of real life, people selling things, candy stores, people walking the first, and children dying naked in the streets, all at the same time. But the young people just stood there for a while. Occasionally, one of the girls pulled at the young man. They burst out in laughter and left. I don't know why, but this reminded me of a scene which I had witnessed a few days earlier, etc. Then he goes on. If one wants to judge favorably the Jews who are spending their money on pastries, parties, and luxury items rather than giving it to charity, one could say that such items aid a person's health and your own life comes first. But when in times like these, Jewish women go to cabarets and entertain themselves there by spending hundreds and often thousands of zlotys each night without giving a groschen to charity, that is the lowest possible moral decline of the Jewish women. Moreover, these cabarets conduct dancing contests as in, quote, the good old days, end quote. Jewish women, girls, and men dance in the contest to receive prize, etc. An article about this appeared in an illegal National Democrat publication under the heading A Dance Among Corpses. Nearly 7,000 funerals take place each month. And that's the topic of this small chapter, is that Jewish women who were historically of the most compassionate, even they, in some cases, obviously he's not saying everyone, but there is a complexity here, and then they were struggling. In a different but kind of related vein, from just a religious practice perspective. In one of our earlier sessions, and I apologize to do this for those who are not there, so I hope you'll forgive me, we discussed a response, a question of a woman who was supposed to go to the mikveh, to go to the ritual bath to immerse in the evening, but there was a curfew. So on the one hand, there was a tremendous effort by some to observe the laws of ritual, family ritual purity, to use the mikveh. But in this volume, which is all about religious Life in the Holocaust, Perspectives on Faith, Halacha, and Leadership During the Holocaust. This is the English translation, Sonya Bibliography, called Hidden in Thunder, Esther Farbstein. She has here an interesting kol kore. A kol kore is a Hebrew term for a placard that was posted, like a, what do you call this thing, a broadside. What's this broadside? The broadside is from the Bergen-Belsen archives of Yad Vashem. Yiddish Efroy. Yiddish Efroy is Yiddish for Jewish women. Yiddish Mutter, Jewish mothers. What's it a plea for? It's a plea, it's a long plea from the Bay by Bnos Agudas Yisrael in Deutschland. What's Deutschland?
Germany.
Germany in the DP camps after the war, to encourage the women to use the mikvahs. Because it was a struggle. There was a struggle first to build mikvahs, and she, in this previous section, this is called Building Among the Ruins, it's a whole section on family life about marriage and divorce. I didn't discuss that today, because marriage and divorce, at least we, the men, do have some, we have some part of it. We're the other half. So that's why I didn't mention it today. But that's a whole other section. But at the end, there's a discussion about how dozens of ritual baths were established in the DP camps, either as converted bathhouses or digging of pits. So rabbis published small booklets. So on the one hand, yes, there were women who were going and using them and participating as they had, but there were women who were not. So I think it's important to, when we talk about the experience of women and the effect that it had on them and their religious reaction, it's important to know that it's not all so simple. And now let's close, maybe to our third section, to look at some specific episodes of inspiration. Here I have an article. I forwarded this article in December, I think, when we talked about Vilna, and I'm happy to email it out again. It's a short 3-page article in English. You have it on your document called Fagel. Oh, I misspelled it. Fagel Demrovs. Fagel Demrovs is an article by... There's no O in Fagel Demrovs. It's an article by Rabbi Dr. Schneer Lyman, one of the foremost Holocaust scholars of our time. Dr. Lyman translates here in an article of in a periodical called Tradition Magazine. This is from 2012, of an eyewitness account of a woman whose nickname was Fagel Demrovs. Fagel Demrovs means, is Yiddish for Fagel. We would say in English, her name would be Faye, which is Fagel is Yiddish for Tzipora. Tzipora is a Hebrew name for a bird, so in Yiddish, they would say Fagel, that's the Yiddish equivalent of Tzipora. Demrovs means the Rav's daughter. And the article describes, and I could send it to you, it's amazing, it's 6 pages in English, it's not a hard read, it's very easy. The article describes Joseph Foxman, some of you know his son Abraham Foxman. So Joseph Foxman, who was born in Baranowicz, which was a very important rabbinic town in Poland, and found himself in the Vilna ghetto, and then made his way to Poland in 1945, and ultimately he came to America in 1949. And he describes what was going on in the Vilna ghetto. And specifically, he writes, "I had the tragic privilege and the great misfortune of participating in the fate of Vilna Jewry during the insufferable and dreadful years of the Hitler regime. Whenever I relive my memories of the past, I stand in awe when confronted by the holy name Fagel Demrovs." Fagel Demrovs was perhaps 21 years old. She was the daughter of Rabbi Beagle of Trochbrod in Volonia. She was in September 1941 in prison with all the Vilna Jewry within the walls of the ghetto. Fagel Demrovs, with a group of other young women, all Beis Yaakov girls. Beis Yaakov was the early women's education of the Jewish religious community. They got together, and they began a group of study. But not only was it a group of study, there were also, she gives the names of the women who were involved. Shoshana, this one, and Leah, this one. You know exactly who he's talking about. Rebbetz and such. Now, it happens to be a postscript that I heard Dr. Lyman talk about this story, and I know one of the women from this group who survived the war, one of the few women. Her name was Miriam. She later escaped to Israel, and she married a very prominent Talmud Chacham, rabbinic scholar by the name of Chaim Yaakov Goldwicht, who was the founder of the yeshiva, the Hesder yeshiva that I learned in, called Keren B'Yavne. The Hesder yeshiva movement in Israel is where you combine army service with Torah study. This was the first founding Hesder yeshiva. So his wife, Rebbetzin Miriam, you knew her. So she was the survivor of this group. Yes, she was in this group. She's mentioned. You could see it in the article. She came eventually. She came to Israel. That's when she married Rav Goldwicht and started up. And that's why their family was involved in publishing some of her father's shiurim from before the war. That's like every story. It's just unbelievable. Every single story is amazing. So this woman, Fagel Dim Ravs, gathers every day for communal prayer and recitation of psalms. She used to lead the Tehillim. Every Shabbos they used to study the Torah portion together. And he describes how she organized so many lectures, Torah and Musar lectures. He says that several instances where she gave the lectures and sometimes she invited men, and it became like a movement. Different places, they had to move out of a house. They had to be held at a certain point in the public kitchen in Dichigas 31. And they decorated the walls. What were the slogans on the walls? So what was the first slogan? It's based on a drashic text. Redemption for any particular generation comes about only by means of the righteous women. That's what they write on the walls of the public kitchen where the women would get together. Next one. Israel was redeemed from Egypt through the merit of the righteous women, etc. Be holy, watch over the Sabbath, and the Sabbath will watch over you. Famous expression. And he says, and with this I'll conclude this component, I had in my possession two handwritten Torah discourses, Foxman writes. He himself had, written by Fagel Dim Ravs. In addition to them was a note of approval with the signer of Rav Yaakov Lutzker Zeldin. One was on Parshas Chayisara, and the other one was on Parshas Vayishlach. This woman was not just an activist, she was a scholar. All of this in the ghetto of Vilna. All of this organized for women, by women. In July of 1944, when the Soviet army reached Latvia, the vast majority of Jews who had been incarcerated in the 20 Latvian concentration camps were transferred by the Nazis to Stutthof near Danzig. Fagel Dim Ravs, together with many of her devoted friends, were among those who were transferred to Stutthof. Only two of them survived. One of them was Rebbetzin Berkovich. That was her maiden name. And her daughter, that's the Rebbetzin Miriam, who married the Rabbi Goldwicht. They too survived. All the others died from starvation and other diseases. Fagel Dim Ravs died from typhus just prior to the liberation of Stutthof. I'll share with you two more stories from two more volumes. We'll come back to where we started. One is from a volume called Ani Mamin. It's a Hebrew work by Mordechai Eliav. I thank Dr. Lyman, because when I reached out to him to get some more research after the Fagel Dim Ravs, he sent me to this volume called Ani Mamin, I believe. And it's, again, stories about religious heroism in the Holocaust. So here he tells the story of a woman in Bergen-Belsen. Her name was Bondi. Her last name was Bondi, which I think is a somewhat common German name. She's in Bondi. And the author of this story, Rav Dr. Shloman Ehrman, he collects this from a volume called Ela Eskera. He says, my wife was in Bergen-Belsen in the women's camp. I'm going to finish in 3 minutes. My wife was in Bergen-Belsen in the women's camp, and her next-door neighbor on the bunk was a woman by the name of Mrs. Bondi. And he says, you can't imagine what this woman was like. Every day, he says, his wife says, that every day she would clean the corner of her barrack. They had a little piece of paper. They didn't have a mop, but they had a piece of paper, and she would clean it to make sure that it looked proper. Every day her husband was in the sick ward, she would visit her husband. But not just that. Every day she was in the most difficult circumstances, she was taking care of her spiritual health. Meaning, on his yard site, her husband had a yard site, she gathered 10 men, even though it was very difficult, and of course it was prohibited, she got 10 men to meet in his hospital room so he could say Kaddish and learn some yard site. How, it says, every Friday she would succeed in lighting Shabbos candles. No one can figure that out. He said, no one can figure it out. He says, not only that, she davened every day. Not only did she pray every day, she prayed 3 times a day. He says she didn't miss even one shacharis or one mariv. And he describes that his wife says that she was such a source of strength for all the people in the barrack. Because to see such a pious woman gave everybody else strength to continue. Until he describes that one Friday night, there were no longer any candles because she passed away. But to think that there's a woman in Bergen-Belsen who's davening Mariv! That means at night she's praying the evening prayer. That is like, it's mind-boggling. The last story is from the work that I mentioned at the beginning, from Haisha Bashawa. It's a story, her name is Leah Newman Weiss. She was first in Auschwitz-Birkenau, then she was in a work camp called Breslau-Hondisfeld, then on a death march, and then she ended up in Bergen-Belsen also. And she describes that it was the winter time, and because they had rags, they'd been given rags for cleaning the machines, that was their work, she was able to scrap together, she decided she's going to light Hanukkah candles. She's going to light Hanukkah candles in her barrack in Bergen-Belsen. Some of these materials, just one more, I didn't put this on your bibliography, but you can get some of these materials online. Most of it is in Hebrew, but Michlala, the Jerusalem College Michlala, my wife went there, so they have a whole Zachor Institute for Holocaust research. Much of their material is online, and that's actually where Reb Yehoshua Eibeshitz, where he published, it was actually out of connected with the Michlala Institute. So you can go online, and it's in Hebrew, but you can look around. Maybe they have something. What I found was a lot of stuff in Hebrew. You can find a lot of these stories and testimonials and videos and books in the Jerusalem College, the Michlala Jerusalem College online resource. So here, she describes this woman, Leah Newman Weiss, how on night of Hanukkah, she's gonna light Hanukkah candles. She said she had some oil from grease from the machine. So she starts scraping together a little bit of the fabric and a little bit of from the rags and a little bit of the oil. Imagine, unbelievable, to light Hanukkah candles. So she says, she describes on the first night of Hanukkah, all the girls, all the women, these young women were in their barrack in Bergen-Belsen. She lights the first Hanukkah candle, and they all sang together Ma'osur. She says, because we almost knew it all from before. We didn't forget it over those 4 years. So here we are, a group of girls lighting Hanukkah candles in a barrack in Bergen-Belsen. This goes on for 4 nights until the 5th night. She says, on the 5th night, we ran into trouble. Because we got out late, and we didn't get to light the little wick until it was after the lights out call. So it was after curfew, when they said lights out in the barrack. So immediately when the lights went out in the whole camp, everybody could see, it was obvious that there was a little light going on in this bunk. So what happens? So the SS woman who is at the gate runs to their block because she sees a little bit of light, and she's thinking for sure these women are putting up a light because they want to attract the attention of the Allies. Remember, Bergen-Belsen, end of the war, the Nazis are worried that's going to be the end. That's why they're driving them there in the death camps, in the death marches. So she comes into the room and she sees every girl sitting on their bed singing Ma'osur. So this woman, Leah Newman Weiss, stands up and she screams at the capo. She says, Achtung! Wait a minute. She says, even though, she says, my blood was freezing, I saw what was going to happen to me. Obviously, what were they going to do to her? Of course they were going to kill her. She says, stop. And 24 shaved heads look at me. 24 pairs of eyes look at me like I'm out of my mind. She says, the woman screams at them, what's going on here? So Leah Neumann Weiss says, she stands up and she says, Giveret Mefakeches, Herr Commandant, this week we have a holiday. It's the holiday to memorialize the heroes of the Maccabees and how a small group of Jews vanquished those who are much more numerous than them. This is what she says to the SS woman who's standing at the head of their barrack. This is what she's writing. I'm not making it up. I'm reading it to you from her own handwriting. At that moment, she says, like, I wasn't really thinking what I was saying to this woman. And I also wasn't planning to be a great heroine. I was just saying it. But I just answered it. Maybe some voice just spoke within me. And I can't tell you what happened. All I can say is that a woman who was near me, my friend, Sarah Wiltzker, my good friend, said to me, just put out the lights. We'll see what happens. She puts out the candles, and the woman leaves. The SS woman leaves. She left quietly, and Leah says, We all wondered what's going to happen the next day. That night she describes how she's in her bed and her friend says to her, are you sleeping? No, I'm not sleeping. So the friend says to her, are you nuts? Did you go crazy with your big speech in front of this SS capo? Are you crazy? Did you lose? Maybe you've lost your mind. She says, no. Sometimes you just... You just speak and then you think. Davar, kara davar lo yu'uman. How does it conclude? Something happened that you would not believe. We didn't get punished. Not only that, that SS woman who took care of us at that night, she took us as a group for our next job to be responsible for food delivery. Which meant that we had a little extra scrap, whatever was left on the side that we can take. And she says that one time that I got a little bit extra, the woman said to me, "Chashavti al oso leil Chanuka, u'michadash shuchnati she'achein haya adavar kedai." She says, the woman says to herself, she says, when I got a little extra food, I realized, it actually paid off. And that's how they end the story. But the idea is that you have women who even didn't even think about it. Her immediate reaction was to stand up to this SS woman and say, we believe that there is a God, that God provided miracles, and that one day, a long time ago, the few were able to vanquish the many. And in this case, she wasn't punished, she wasn't murdered, she went to live, she even got a little extra food. But the idea that Jewish women were heroic in an extraordinary measure that's difficult to even understand is something that's borne out by literally countless stories. Countless. I'm giving you one drop in seven volumes of stories. Just one of seven volumes. And we could go on for many, many hours. But the idea that I wanted to share this morning is, number one, thinking about the suffering of Jewish women, how they dealt with that from a religious standpoint, the complexity of the impact that it had on Jewish women, for better and for worse, unfortunately, but also the unique heroism of these Jewish women and how, from a religious standpoint, they were willing even to stand up to an SS woman to be able to express their religious beliefs.